Hello and welcome once again to Core Ideas, Paleolimnology Podcast, where we delve into all things lake sediments. And as always, we're your hosts, myself, Adam Jaziorski.
And Josh Sienpont. Thanks for coming back again.
All right, Josh, what do you want to talk about today?
I don't know. What do you think? Any thoughts?
I think we could follow the arc of contagious ideas a little bit deeper. And one thing I've been thinking about a fair bit while working from home is basically about open relationships within paleolimnology.
Oh dear, Adam. Well, I don't know what to say about that.
Get your mind out of the gutter. We're talking about open access to scientific research and data.
Oh, thank goodness. Okay, perfect.
Come on. This is G-rated, buddy.
Well, it's not, though. It's a podcast. We can say anything we like, especially because it's our podcast. But it's an interesting topic. It's an important topic. And it is a topic that very much fits into the vein of a contagious idea, because it is something that has rapidly increased in the scientific literature of all kinds, broadly, and paleolimnology just being one example of that. So a really good choice, I think.
And what made me think about it, or like something to look into a little bit more, was just while working at home and the need to use a proxy access or VPN through the university to access journal articles. And I don't think we mentioned this last time, or not last time, a couple episodes ago when we were looking at citations, but to even like open Web of Science, which we talked about a fair bit, you need to have a subscription or a access to it. Through some institution. So, you know, to even look at what we were talking about in there, you know, required
being a paying customer. Access.
Yeah. And when we're talking about open access, we're talking about like the complete reverse of that. Just general access to the general public on some level, and to research data or... Yeah, specifically research data is what we're talking about today. And this is very much a contagious idea. And it really has its roots in the, I guess initially I was thinking it'd be in the early 2000s, but earlier than that, going back into the late 80s, 90s, and just, you know, the birth of the internet. And is now, I don't know if you'd call it a household term, but a very widely known term within science. And I'm pretty sure most people, when you say open access, they have a rough idea of what you're talking about because it's got close ties to the idea of like open source or free software and all the various political and philosophical connotations that comes along with it.
Yeah, and it's something that I would imagine is even people may not recognize it as much in the popular media, but related to this whole COVID-19 thing, there's so much free scientific information that's coming out that is intentionally being put into an open access framework by publishers, even at the really large publishing houses, like up to the Nature Publishing Group kind of level, specifically so that people have access to that information on this really important topic outside of the paywall, and really bringing this into the fold and being a topic that, you know, people are coming to realize that, hey, you know, it's nice to have access to scientific data and not having to go through a university institution because you may not have it, or it's just really challenging to do, is a real benefit.
Oh, I think so. And like a key thing that we probably should define early on, even before we define what we mean exactly by open access, is just a little bit as what does free mean?
That's and a really, it's a challenging question.
It is.
An interesting one.
And especially within English. And this, for anyone familiar with the concepts of free software and open source, be a very familiar distinction because there are two concepts tied up in the single word of free in English. And I guess you could be talking about gratis versus libra. So the question of whether something is free as in beer versus free as in freedom.
Which is free as in speech, the other way to think about that one. Yeah.
As a distinction. And so if something just has no cost, as in free as in beer, here is a beer, you drink it, the end. Versus free as in speech, and able to do whatever you want with it.
Yeah.
Or the thing. And
yeah, which from a software perspective, people use every day. You know, people are accessing free software. People are using browsers that are free, but they may not be open in the same perspective as some of the others. And some are.
Yeah. And one thing while doing the research for this, I particularly liked was there's a free beer out there that plays on this whole idea, in that it is a free beer in terms of the Libra connotation of free. So their logo and their recipe are all under some sort of Creative Commons open license. But it seems like just a big play on words to be able to have free beer, $5 as like their sign or whatever the price would be.
I love it. I think it's a great idea. If someone buys you one of those, like you now truly have free as in speech beer.
Yeah.
That's great.
And
it's so nerdy. That's so nerdy.
Yeah. But to pull this back a bit to research and science, the distinction comes in, like, even if you have the paper or access to the paper for free, so you can read it for free, you're not necessarily able to then free to share it with other people. And this is where all licensing kind of things coalesce into what can you do with something that you've been given for free.
Mm-hmm. And I guess the one thing to think about is that, you know, from an academic perspective, this is something that's always a bit of a challenge, because as the author of the publication, you can share reprints of it and things like that, but it still might be completely behind the paywall of the publishing house. And this is sort of the stages along that towards truly being able to do anything with that document when it's done.
And okay, so I think it's time to drop a long definition in, and what exactly are we talking about in terms of open access. And there were a couple, because there were, I guess, a couple of different movements, meetings, conferences that laid out exactly what the idea was behind open science in the early 2000s. So I'm going to give here the Bethesda Statement on Open Access Publishing that dates back to 2003 and was one of several conferences that tried to define what this meant in terms of open access versus open journals, and how they defined open access with respect to a journal would be free, irrevocable, worldwide, perpetual right of access to, and a license to copy, use, distribute, transmit, and display the work publicly, and to make and distribute derivative works in any digital medium for any responsible purpose, subject to proper attribution of authorship, and from which every article is deposited immediately upon initial publication in at least one online repository. So it's a mouthful. Like, these, it's not a simple concept.
I don't think there's a word in there that's less than four letters. There's some serious ideas in there, but it gets to the heart of the idea is that you have access to the article for free forever. You can alter it. You can do things with it and alter it as long as you provide that key attribution of the authorship.
So where it came from. So you can build on it. You can make derivative works. You can do it digitally. And just all the only catch is, you know, if you do use it or make it or distribute it, or you have to say where it came from.
Yeah. And I think that's a funny, that was a fairly long definition, but that's the shortest of the ones that came about at this time period in the early 2000s, when, as Adam said, there were a few things kind of coming together in order to establish what these ideas really meant. And I think, there's a lot of legalese kind of information in there, but it is fairly straightforward to think that, you know, these are all the things that you might want to do with that work.
Because what was happening is at this point, you know, this is a reaction, I guess, to like the internet had gone through was already well into its proliferation. We're past like, you know, the dot-com bubble collapsing at this point. So the internet was well known, and we're at the point that a general transition was going on, at least in academia, and to, you know, PDFs were as like the medium of science, I guess, and being distributed was like on the uptick in a big way. And it was just a lot of questions of, you know, it's one thing if you have a subscription to a particular journal, you have that issue, you give it, lend it to other people at coffee break, and then theoretically they give it back to you, but it's still only one. But once everything went digital, all of a sudden it's like, here's a paper. Whether or not, you know, I'm an author is irrelevant to the actual discussion, because all of a sudden, here's a copy for you, a copy for you, a copy for you, and a couple of million of my closest friends. But when I hosted on like the university website. And so there was a legal, I don't know, quagmire.
Yeah, it was a question that really didn't need to be asked before that in wide scale use. That was the time period. You know, people weren't going to the stacks to, you might make one photocopy of a paper from a journal at the library stack. Or if you were an author, you might get a stack, you know, 6 inches high of 100 reprints that you could mail to all of the people who asked for it. But when they became portable documents, digital copies, then these kind of ideas really had to come to the front, because copyright was an important component. And the publishing houses obviously wanted to maintain their copyright over selling access to individual articles, which has become more popular. Probably, maybe, I don't remember it being as big of a thing sort of in the early part of digital publishing. Maybe it was there and I just didn't pay attention to it.
Yeah.
But certainly selling institutional licenses is where they get their huge amount of capital for those companies.
Yeah, I don't remember the first time I saw, like, you know, when you're trying to log in from home, let's say, you can access this article for like $19.99.
You can rent it for 24 hours for $6 or whatever it is. I'm not sure that was a common thing.
The main thing I really remember from that time period was like the as stuff became digitized, there was like a moving wall of time as older stuff gradually became digital. So
for sure,
I definitely remember a key thing of like, I want to pull up this article and say, it's not available online, and that distinction of like when I'm not old, but I'm old enough to, at the beginning of my academic studies, it was all about the book stacks and going, and then that transition happened kind of in between me finishing undergrad to being well into my master's, of the journeys to the book stacks became less and less necessary.
Yeah, I know, where they would be old for only certain journals that hadn't gone online yet. I remember the Arctic Institute of North America produces the Arctic Journal, and they're not associated with any of the publishing houses. They were quite late in putting all of their old back catalog onto an online portal. So I remember that was probably the last time I went to the Queen's Library at this point to look for a specific journal article, because it just wasn't available.
Because I remember an interaction I had with my supervisor, John, during my PhD, where I was maybe like 2 years in, 2-3 years in or something, and I made a question about like, next time I go to the library to do some photocopying, and I'm like, I've never been to the library to do any photocopying since I came to Queens. And
one of those moments, like, he's like, oh.
What?
It's just been so many hours in Douglas Library. Yeah. I used to study in that library. It was a great place to study.
Yeah.
As an undergrad.
Yeah. So it was the same thing, but it was not at that point. I was no longer, maybe a couple of old papers.
One of the nice things, actually, I think John had a great collection. Like, he had Arctic, that journal I was talking about, going back for many years. He didn't actually have to go to the library because people had back catalogs of those journals. But yeah, moving on to from that definition and the ways in which you can, codify the different open access types or flavors or things like that.
Classifications.
To fit within these different licenses. So are we talking about free as in speech, or is it free as in beer, or is it some variation in between those different in between those different categories. And I'm not sure who they are that arrived at this series of different colors in order to codify what those are, but they exist. And they're not intuitive colors because they go from things like gold to green to bronze, and there are some in between there, but they do correspond to these different licensing of, or these different open categories.
Yeah. And so when you're talking about open access, like a gold rating or open access gold, would mean, the name is a play on like the gold standard. Basically, everything is cool. It's like you can access it for free. The authors can do whatever they want with their own level of self-archiving. And the license is a very, very, very open one. One step down from that would be open access green, where the publishing house allows self-archiving, and that's where you get into things like archive.org.
Everyone out there, a few minutes ago when we were discussing the like order of things we were going to talk about, my mind may have literally skipped a few seconds of time as I comprehended and tried to integrate the fact that archive.org, which is...
It's not arXiv.
Yeah, it's not arXiv, Josh, which is HTTPS. AR, what when you're typing it into a browser, is a small X, but it should be a capital X. And really, by a capital X, it should be the chi Greek letter. And then iv.org. So it's archive.org. And when Adam told me that, I actually sat quietly in my seat for almost 20 seconds.
It's like a nerdy joke that went over his head for like the last 20 years. And it just, that's not supposed to happen.
It's not supposed to happen. I'm a smarter guy than that. I thought so anyway. Yeah, so that was a great revelation. And I hope at least one other person of our 27 regular listeners may be joining me in this revelation. So continuing, sorry.
Yeah, so then, so archive.org is a place for like self-archiving. I personally never used it. I think it really lends itself more to like the physics and mathy type.
Engineering.
Elements of science where, mm-hmm. Everything's produced in LaTeX and the uploading and the file sizes are all much smaller than a lot of things that we deal with.
People put preprints up on that service as well, and postprint, like archived in the green sort of open access sort of style. So there's quite a bit of information on there, not just after publication, which would fall into the sort of green open access model. There are preprints on there as well, but it is a great...
I guess one thing that Hamblin is just defining those terms. So a preprint would be a copy of the document that you've sent out to peer review.
So it's a work in progress. It's been submitted, but it hasn't been reviewed. But it's really become common to see, especially again, going back to this COVID sort of thing, newspaper articles and people like really discussing data that aren't reviewed, which is interesting.
And then you have the postprint, which would then be you have gone through the peer review, but it's still in, document form. Let's say, I don't know how better to describe it.
It's off. It's not paginated. It's not set into the journal.
Yeah, it's not gone through the typesetting setting. So it's not like...
And it may not have been copy edited as well, which is another often final stage after the scientific editing kind of component. So there may be minor changes after the post print before it goes to the published version, which is after it's been copy edited and it's been typeset.
And in the journal's format, given page numbers and all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm.
And one of the nice things about maybe before we move on from the green open access is that all of these self-archived type of things can receive DOIs, digital object identifiers. So they can be citable even though they may not be linked to either a journal yet or to the actual journal's publication. And that's really important because in order to be able to cite something in your subsequent work, and given that reviews can take quite a long time currently, some data that are really rapid communications, you want to be able to access quite early, especially if you're following up your own research. And so having that citable DOI in a self-archived preprint or even postprint option is a really useful tool.
All right, so moving on, having defined the concept of open access, I guess the next step would be to talk about how does it actually affect scientists? And I'm not sure we can actually single out paleolimnologists in particular. This is a pretty broad topic compared to a lot of stuff we normally talk about. Although I guess the last couple of episodes have been pretty broad in scope, and this is like continuing the trend. But the way that I think about it is in practical terms, in terms of accessing the research, it really just comes down to, does the reader pay or does the author pay?
Yeah, it's unfortunate that that has to be the distinction, but there we are. Does the reader pay, maybe not individually, but through their institution if they're associated with one, or do they pay individually for the article? Or if it's certain open access journals, I'm not sure of any that are true, they're free to the authors. Do they pay an APC, an article processing charge, in order to publish it in that journal, if it's all open access, or to make that article open access if it's in a journal that traditionally is paywalled?
Yeah. Because it's interesting when you kind of start thinking about the actual business model of scientific journals, at least in the recent past. I guess if we go back to like the founding of the societies, it would have been, you know, a newsletter equivalent that went out to the members of past research. But in the last, you know, I guess post-war period, the idea is that scientists give the journals the product, their research, for free. You sign off all your rights associated with the work.
Other than your continued use of it and that sort of thing. But yeah, in terms of its publication, it cannot be published again.
Yep. And then the journal companies then sell that. And then the researcher doesn't have to worry about any businessy crap. They just move on. They publish the stuff out so that it can be read. And they don't worry about, you know, the cost of ink or printing presses.
Yeah, exactly.
Or distribution or anything like that. Any business side of things or any of the costs associated with it. They just get it out in there, go back to the lab or wherever, however the research is performed, and continue. And because, you know, in terms of readership, no individual scientist, you know, would be going, I'm like losing out on a bundle here if I just sold my papers individually for $19.99 to the general public. I'd be, that has all been turned on its head now with the open access idea. And so instead, the journal gives out the product for free to the general public or whoever it may be, but, you know, in full open access, the general public. And it is the researcher that pays for all the costs in advance that do go into typesetting, distribution, and all those kind of things.
Paying the staff who do all of those things. Yeah. It's an interesting, there's a lot of discussion ongoing about the business model of the journal publishing and how these are some of the largest companies on earth in some ways basically the product is given to them for free. The people who handle not all of the work, but much of the work for free, the reviewers, the editors, and then they sell it for a decent amount of money to every university who wants access to these journals. And then they bundle them with all sorts of journals. So if you want a couple of them, you have to buy all of them.
It's like cable TV.
Yeah, exactly. And it's an interesting difference as you move to this open access. Now you're still paying to publish your own work that you did all the work for, and you paid for all the actual research and the student salaries and all of those things. And now you have to give this company this amount of money in order to do all of that. And some of them are quite expensive. Others are a little more reasonable. But there's a pretty big range of what those APCs are, depending on the journal. So, it'll be interesting to see sort of moving forward 20, 25 years where we find ourselves on this spectrum.
To see how it all shakes out.
Yeah, because I'm not sure we've arrived at what is a sustainable final situation for the whole thing.
No, yeah, because we're definitely, we're 15, 17 years into past open access being defined. There are, it's a well-understood concept. There are many open access journals out there, but we're still working through the whole what the knock-on effects in terms of funding implications are.
Yeah.
Because research labs are often working on incredibly tight budgets. So having...
Yeah, grants are incredibly competitive. You can only do so much with that money, and setting aside a fair bit in order to make your articles open access is that's the equivalent. Like in a grant recently we just put in, it's equivalent to a year of a student's salary to say you're going to publish all of these in gold open access. Like that's a hard trade-off to have to make. Like, do I want to fund another student for a year be able to pay them for that year? Or do I want to make all my articles open access?
Yeah. And then especially, in terms of, I guess there's both sides of this coin in terms of conceptualizing how big a chunk of an annual budget this would represent. Would be on the one hand in a very small lab if you only have one or two students, and then you go, okay, well, instead of having two students over the course of this grant period, I'm going to have one and a half, and then worry about a second one in the next grant period and save the money for funding for publication costs. Or then in like a very large lab where you have like 10 to 20 students, and then all of a sudden if you want to make everything open access, very quickly, you're in like, you could be breaking into six digits.
Easily. Yeah. Yeah. That's a challenge to fund that, for anyone, even people who are bringing in enough to have a lab of that size. And then as you move to certain, requirements, so here in Canada, it is now a requirement that projects which are funded through the Tri-Council agencies, so SHRC, SEER, and NSERC, which is the one that aligns with paleolimnologists generally, that the data must be published in some way that is accessible to the people who are paying for it, which is the public. So that might be as a preprint or as a postprint version of the article, but there is a requirement of it. So there's a push to make this more the case and to get into that framework. And I think it's a great idea. Like I'm all about trying to figure out how to do that, but sometimes just paying out the APC is not always possible.
And then when you do some of the reading going forward, you almost wonder, if you could hop in the time machine and skip 25 years down the line, will there eventually be is it just going to be like the money moves from the right hand to the left hand. So instead of the universities paying the journals for access, that just ends up becoming a straight switch for the journal, the universities paying a lump sum based on the size of the university to the journals for publication. Or something on that level. Yeah. Like it ends up becoming a real it's going to have to eventually go on to a macro level. Because the micromanaging of it is so complex.
I could see that that's possible for sure.
And then I guess, and then it becomes a case of what changed. I guess the main one is the general public got access, and then science became a lot more accessible in developing countries, for example, that would be unable to necessarily get get past the paywalls as they currently exist. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, for sure. And for some, all credit to certain societies or journals and things like that. Sometimes there are lower fees associated with different geographic locations, just as there are with, paying your membership dues and that kind of thing. So there are some options there. But yeah, no, it can be a fair bit of money. And if you don't have it, a lot of the people listening are probably associated with an academic institution. So you kind of get used to having access to all of that information. But when it's lost, it is an enormous privilege that we have to have access to all of those different bits of science that we're interested in going back all these different years. And it would be very nice if that wasn't the case, if that we could figure out a model that allowed people to have access to all of the information.
That, yeah. So that the I have zero interest in the business side of things. So, just getting rid of the barriers, but allowing the journals still to be for all the typesetting and all that kind of stuff and to be done, and the journals still exist and just have everybody access them.
Yeah.
That'd be great. And it's for someone.
What a wonderful world it would be. Yep.
With a much higher pay grade than my own to sort out. I guess one thing we've not touched on would be that the access doesn't just refer, I guess you did mention it in passing, it doesn't only refer to the actual articles themselves. There's the actual data, access to the data is a thing as well. And more you're starting to see, especially references to open access to code.
Yeah, which is huge.
To be able to rerun the analyses yourself in something like R, if the actual code that they use to generate it is posted up. But how much experience do you actually have yourself with open access journals?
I have published, I think, two papers that are entirely in open access journals. So the entire journal is open access. I don't know that I've ever paid or been part of a project that has paid to have an open access article within a journal that's under a traditional paywall. So I don't know how that process works. I might be wrong on a paper or two that I'm kind of in the middle of a big author list. So I would say that it's just the two articles I have. So I have a paper that's in PLOS One.
Your tune.
Yeah. I always called it PLOS One, and Adam, this is my second pronunciation. This is really a podcast episode about pronouncing strange words and how Josh has been doing it wrong for some time. So I had a paper in PLOS One, which is one of the, I wouldn't say it's one of the original, but it's sort of a fairly early open access journal.
This is the Public Library of Science.
Yeah, and PLOS One is actually not the earliest of their journals. It only came out, I think, in 2006 or 2003, whereas the Public Library of Science has been doing open access journals of different kinds. So they have different journals, like many of the big publishers do. But they're all open access, and they've been doing them for many years. And then I have an article in Nature Communications, which is one of Nature's open access journals that has fairly high APCs associated with those articles.
How high?
I don't remember off the top of my head. Several thousand US dollars, I would say.
Yeah, no, it's so I myself have never published in a open access journal, but I definitely have seen the checkbox in, I guess, whatever you want to call it, standard journals of, would you like to pay $5,000 to make this an open access article? And I've declined every single time.
Yeah, as most people do. Rightly so. So I just quickly typed in, and the APC currently for Nature Communications is 5,380 US dollars, which is a lot of money. And that was an article that we weren't, we were happy to pay that fee. One, it's a good journal, but it was also an article that we wanted open access. So we kind of went into it because it was part of a project that was really had a lot of community interaction with related to movement of the wood bison in the Northwest Territory. So we thought that there might be some, we would want to be able to share that article in any way we could. So we kind of went into it thinking that, yeah, this is something we'd be interested in incorporating into this. And so that was fun. But so I would say I don't have a great deal of experience in that. But there are more and more of them, journals that are all open access. So did we talk about Facets? I think we did in the scientific societies, because it has been adopted as the journal of the Royal Society of Canada's science division or directorate or whatever they're called. And they are an open access journal. And I recall not long after our PLOS One paper came out, having a discussion with someone from NRC Press, who contacted me through John Small to ask about sort of the process of how working with PLOS One had been, because they were just starting to get Facets off the ground from a planning perspective, and they wanted to talk about the way in which the system had worked at
the author experience.
Yeah, the author experience at sort of what is, I would say the PLOS One is sort of the maybe best known of the truly open access journals. It's sort of, I wouldn't say the gold standard, because that's mixing terms a little bit, but it's a really well-known one, a really well-respected one. And so they were interested in that. And a few years later, Facets came to be.
Yeah, because I think this is something that is coming up more and more. And we're really, you know, we're at the tip of the iceberg. It's only going to become a bigger deal moving forward in terms of open access. And I think it's pretty interesting that, you know, outside of journals, the journal component of open access, like one of the projects I'm involved right now, like has a huge public access component. So the Lake Pulse Survey, like one of their deliverables, I guess would be one way to describe it. One of the things that they're going to produce, like once the actual project is done, is a web portal that all the data from the surveys will be open to the public. So on one level, you know, individual Joe or Jane Q public is interested in a particular lake, they can click on it and pull up the data that the survey produced about their particular lake or the lake that they go to fish on or whatever it may be. But also that it'll just be publicly available for data mining to build into bigger projects going forward.
Which is huge, because there'll be so much information that comes out of that project to be, you know, in many ways, that's more powerful than being able to read someone's interpretation of one tiny little section of data. The availability of large data sets to be used is becoming more and more important in science, because I think we've come to realize that, you know, you spend all this time collecting these data, and of course you have important things to do, but you can never fully access and integrate that into other things. And so to be willing to share data, and it's really expensive to collect these data. I don't know. I feel like we need to get as much out of them as we can, especially for a project like Lake Pulse, which is absolutely massive. It just seems like that is somewhere that we are getting to, and it's a great change in science that's happened over the last however many years.
Yeah. And I think, you know, it's one of those things that as it snowballs, it'll become more and more powerful. I guess one thing when I was saying to try and bring this all back to paleolimnology, when we're thinking about open access and how much direct involvement I've had through like my, as a graduate student moving forward, it was incredibly limited. I knew what it was, but I'd never done it. But then it was also limited, especially paleolimnology in terms of a standard stratigraphy. Like, if you digitize a graph, you can pull out the data, you know, without getting access to the data. And this happens fairly commonly. But as the data set grows and grows and grows, you know, the ability to access the data directly becomes more and more and more important if you want to do anything further with it.
Yeah, absolutely.
And yeah, and so I think going forward, again, hopping into that time machine, I think ourselves 20 years in the future, like just playing on the idea that Back to the Future just turned like 35 years old over the weekend or something, of jumping into that.
Yeah, they were DeLorean. Talking about it on the radio this morning when I was in the car.
And jumping in the future and like going, and talking to our future selves go, can't believe you spent an hour talking about open access. It's like, what are you going to do next? Spending an hour talking about breathing? It's like, obviously,
maybe
it's important.
And I hope so. I think that'd be great. I hope this is redundant, even quicker than 35 years, which now I realize that was the year I was born. I hope so. I think that would be a great legacy of science and science publishing to be able to sort that out. We'll see, I guess. But as we see it right now, I think we're arriving at something that's workable and there really is a shift. Like there's good evidence that articles that are open access get cited more. They get passed around in social media more, which is increasingly a really important way of sharing science. And because of that, when open access articles start to be better accessed, it can only result, hopefully at least, in a greater push for people to, you know, it's an incentive to actually begin to work in that framework, I would hope. Anyway.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's very much, you know, the snowball is definitely rolling and we don't know how much bigger it's going to get, but it's going to get bigger.
Agreed. As Adam was talking in the last section, I quickly looked up what the current article processing charge for JOPL is, because in the thing, so that's a Springer journal. So it's related to all of the Springer. It would be considered a hybrid journal, not a fully open access. And in a developed country, it would be $3,200 and some odd dollars US. So a little bit cheaper than Nature Communications, but still a fair chunk of change.
Yeah, it's, you know, and labs operating on a shoestring budget, you know, $3,000 is
US.
You know, yeah. The US is one of, like, you know, it's not sitting in petty cash, let's say.
Certainly not. Yeah. That can fund a whole lot of microscope slides if you're making slides or good part of the maintenance for a microscope.
Yeah. All right. So I think that's a good place to wrap it up.
Yeah, I think so. I'm not sure if we intended to incorporate anything. We had talked about talking about Creative Commons a little bit, but I think that might be a separate topic a little bit beyond that. The Creative Commons, just very briefly, because it is linked to this, because some of those journals, like, for example, Springer Open articles have a Creative Commons license. They're based under this. The Creative Commons, very briefly, is sort of a nonprofit organization that is set up to deal with the legal challenges associated with sharing information broadly. So they have the really important thing that comes out of their work, and they do lots of interesting things, but is to have these different licenses associated with different types of data, so that you can have basically the things we've been talking about. You can have data that are in the public domain, which is often the case for government produced information. So if you are say you're trying to use a figure that you like, and it's produced by the US Geological Survey, those are completely public domain. You can do anything you like with them. You can edit them. You don't even really have to attribute them in theory, though you should. And that can go to different levels that have more restrictions associated with them. So these would be what the Creative Commons licenses are. You can have licenses where you just need to give credit to the author. You can have a license that you give credit. And if you adapt them, you have to share them under the same terms. So you can use my image, but if you use it, you can't make it copyrighted. You can only share it under the same licenses, and they go on from there. You can have ones that are non-commercial. You can have ones that are not allowed to be modified. They're all different licenses that they structure. And so when you have, say, an image, and a common way to share pictures is through these Creative Commons licenses, and you can search on their website, which is really useful. You can say that when I give you access to this image, I'm giving it under this Creative Commons license. So if you go on Wikipedia, the Wikimedia Commons, the vast majority of those images that you see in all of the different wikis are Creative Commons licensed under one form or the other. Most of them, the the levels that allow some sort of changes to be made. So very briefly, that's what the Creative Commons is.
Yeah, that's almost something we explore into in more detail in the future.
Yeah, it's something I've been thinking a fair bit about related to my teaching, because I'm interested in kind of making some of my information in that, and videos and stuff that I'm doing, especially in this online teaching world, Creative Commons licensed. And by doing so, I've been really careful to make sure that all of the material that I incorporate is also Creative Commons licensed. So I'm not using copyrighted material, which I mean, I try to think about all the time, but this is really important for that if I'm to license my own stuff. So yeah, it may be an interesting topic for future.
Yeah. So I'm just spitballing. So you may be interested in, whatever course number is, material going out onto the open internet. But is the university necessarily on board with that in terms of, sending everything out into the ether, anyone can do whatever they want with?
That's a really good question. And I think it depends on the university. So some of them, some universities claim copyright over their faculty's lecture material. So they have copyright to it. That does exist. It's not as common at some places. In Canada, at York, that's not the case. So we retain our own copyright to our lectures effectively. And we're given pretty broad scope to do what we want with them, including if we want to make them accessible through the Creative Commons. And there's been a lot of information that's been put forward in this new online world to do that if we want to. So I would say that probably depends at the institution, but we found good luck with that.
Okay. I'm sure there's a big continuum in terms of huge. Free as in beer and versus free as in speech the whole way down on a whole other domain, I guess.
Yeah. It's an interesting combination of copyright law combined with academic integrity and academic freedom and all these different things that I'm very just briefly have a few minutes to sort of read on the side about, but find quite interesting. So you maybe ask me in a few months and I'll have more to share.
Those topics are definitely my passion.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah, not until you get into it.
Okay.
But no, otherwise I think that was a good little segue, good little jump into this, and hopefully we'll come back to this and have something more to share in the future.
Sounds good. All right. So really time to wrap it up now?
Let's wrap it up.
Okay. So thank you for listening once again. And if you want to get in touch with us, you can write us at the show website, coreideaspodcast@gmail.com. But more likely, you'll probably want to get in touch with us via Twitter. What's the handle again, Josh?
It's at coreideaspaleo, P-A-L-E-O, the American spelling.
And is there anything in the mailbag today?
So we had a couple of likes on Twitter. And then I had a nice email on another topic, but shout out to Yella Faber at the University of Waterloo. He was wrapping up his studies there, who said very nice things about the podcast. And so it's nice to know that someone's out there listening, and we're glad that you are. And
thank you very much. Yeah. We appreciate it a lot. And I had one interaction as well with a listener, let's say. And we've got a correction. So on the last released episode about citation counts, we made a fairly big error in terms of the highest cited paleo paper.
That was a good point. I only just remembered you sent this to me. So by the time this episode releases, there'll be another one out there. But who is it? If you're willing to say, who was it that pointed this out to us? Because you never told me that.
It's Karsten.
Oh, okay.
And that's why I'm saying I put listener in air quotes, because I don't think he actually listened to the episode, but I talked to him about it. And he's like, no, you missed one. And it's like the Oliver Hirey paper on LOI has way higher than 1,000 citations.
Well, we weren't saying that was the highest ever. It was just the highest of the author. So I don't think we were wrong. But it's a very good point that is a paleo paper that is exceptionally well cited. And I hadn't thought of it. And when you sent it to me, I'm like, of course, that one is so well, I mean, it's in everything.
our mystique of authority on any paleo topic is now kind of like shattered, I think.
Did we have a mistake?
No, we have absolutely none. But we appreciate it being brought to our attention, and we're sorry for not catching that at the time.
I'm surprised we didn't link to it.
You know, in our highly scientific clicking exercise.
And if I recall, it had something like 6,000 citations on Google Scholar. That's what I recall. Something in that range. I might be off by a few, but.
But yeah, so it was significantly higher. I don't remember off the top of my head how high it was, but it was several times, several thousand for sure.
Mm-hmm. And a very good paper.
Yep.
And so thanks, Karsten. Although you're not listening.
we absolutely love hearing feedback, and it's now that we're 16 episodes in, starting to roll in a little bit. Keep it coming, and because we do this largely for ourselves because we think it's fun and looking into these topics, but throwing it out into the ether, hoping that someone else can find some value in it or interest in it or entertainment in it is a pretty cool thing. And if you want to look into past episodes, you can visit our website at coreideas.ajzorski.ca. So coreideas.ajzorski.ca. And until next time, thanks for listening. We've had fun, and stay safe out there.
Yeah, take care. We'll see you next time.